Midweek Musings, which I guess is like a half an episode. And if I had a, if I was really cheesy on the branding front, I would call this Midweek Midweek Musings, and then just pretend like I had a lisp. But then the lisp crowd would get really mad at me, and they'd say that I was, being bigoted and mean towards lispers, so can't have that. So we'll just call it Midweek Musings. What's up? It's midweek, it's Wednesday, and, I did an episode a while back called Evidence Ignoring Argumentation, and, the pushback on my laissez-faire position made me think that I have two choices in front of me. One, I could actually take my advice and not be one who adheres to evidence-ignoring argumentation, or I can just bury my head in the sand and continue to insist that laissez-faire is bulletproof, infallible, and the best economic system known to man. So I'm choosing the latter. No, actually I'm not, as you can probably tell by the title of this episode, which is called When Laissez-Faire Fails. Dun, dun, dun. No, it has made me think about when laissez-faire fails. And so I'm gonna ruminate on that, talk about that a little bit, because I have a handful of thoughts. But before I do that, if you recall me talking about people losing match points in tennis previously, look no further than last Sunday's Wimbledon final between Roger Federer and Novak Djokovic. And Roger Federer had two match points against Djokovic again in a Grand Slam. It's the third time in Federer's esteemed career that he has had two match points on his serve against Novak Djokovic in a Grand Slam and lost the match. So that's got to sting. But I did like Federer's post-match interview when he said that hopefully he can inspire some other 37-year-olds to believe that 37 is not the end of the road. And I thought, I sure as heck hope he's talking about fellow tennis players and not people just who are 37 in their lives, because that would be quite depressing if you think that the end of your road is when you hit 37. And if that was the case, I would have hit the end of the road 3 years ago. So yeah, come on, Federer, clarify that to making sure you're talking about other tennis players who are 37, not just life in general. What else happened? Simona Halep won the Wimbledon women's final, becoming the first Romanian to win Wimbledon. She was not the first Romanian to win a Grand Slam. I believe that honor is given to some chick in 1978 who won the French Open, if memory serves me. 1978 French Open. Oh, look at that, women's tennis champion. I'm pretty sure that's the year that the Romanian woman won it. Oh yeah, that's right, Virginia Ruzici. Former professional tennis player from Romania. She won the 1978 French Open Singles Championship. Career titles, 12. Yeah, she won it in 1978. She made the quarterfinals, Australian Open 1980. Wimbledon quarterfinals 78 and 81, and the U.S. Open quarterfinals 76 and 78. I'm guessing those quarterfinal losses were probably to Chris Evert, Martina Navratilova, Hanna Manlikova, somewhere in there. Those would be my guesses. And you know what's really cool, and I actually think we can do this. Let's see. Oh, they don't have it linked. Huh. Let's do this. We're gonna figure this out. We're gonna go to Wimbledon, and we are going to click. Actually, you know what? I'm gonna do this. 1978 Wimbledon draw. There we go. And what's cool is in Wikipedia, it's pretty amazing what these people have started to do. Does it go back? Yes, it does. They've started to put the draw in, which is phenomenal. So let me see. Oh, so 78, Wimbledon, she lost to Yvonne Goolagong-Cowley in the Wimbledon quarterfinals. And then Navratilova beat Goolagong in the semis. And then Navratilova beat Chris Everett in the final. Anyway, it's pretty cool. You can go back and look at every single round, and it has the scores, which may or may not be how I spend the wee hours of the morning when I have insomnia, clicking through all of these old Grand Slam draws and going, oh yeah, I remember that person. Oh wow, that person beat that person. Good times. Anyway, I'm not going to do that for all of them. But my guess is she probably lost to one of those three people the majority of the time in those quarterfinals. But Virginia Ruzici, the first Romanian woman. I think, did Ilie Nastase win any Grand Slams? I'm going to say no. I think he was just a firebrand that never won a Grand Slam. I don't think he did. Am I gonna regret this? I don't think he did. What? He won the French Open in 73 and the US Open in 72. So apparently Nastase was the first Romanian to win some Grand Slams. And Ruzici was the first Romanian woman. I did not realize that Nastase won some Grand Slams. That was a little bit before my time. I've just seen some old YouTube clips about him causing... You think Nick Kyrgios is crazy. It appears that Ilie Nastase was just as crazy. So anyway, Wimbledon happened. What's his name? Nicolas Mahut became the equivalent of a speed punching bag in the men's doubles final. If you go look on ESPN, they have a compilation of him getting blasted. One with an overhead above the eye. One with a forehand return in the shoulder, which was kind of tame. He played that one up like a soccer player. And the third one, he took a swinging backhand volley directly to the package. And if you don't know what I'm talking about when I say package, go watch the video and then you'll probably cringe a little bit. But it's funny because the previous episode, like just 2 weeks ago, I was talking about people getting hit with tennis balls and how Nadal was such a pansy because he acted like he got killed. And then this guy nearly lost an eye when he ran headfirst into an overhead that otherwise would have missed him. If he hadn't guessed and anticipated one way, it would have missed him entirely. So entirely his fault. No malice on the part of the opponent. He did clearly run into all three shots. So funny stuff. All right, so we're going to talk about when laissez-faire fails and then maybe kind of delve off into a stupid article on Scientific American talking about fat people and maybe another stupid study that came out of Canada talking about the oppressive nature of dodgeball. Why does everything have to be systemic now? Everything is systemic. Play a game of dodgeball and it's a sign of systemic oppression. Oh, Lord. So when laissez-faire fails, and you go, well, where are you going to start? What examples are you going to start with? Because laissez-faire has never failed. Laissez-faire is immaculate. Of course, I'm kidding. Well, I'm not going to start with the bigger systemic failures like the banking crisis and the Great Depression and those sorts of things. Because in my opinion, as I examine the evidence surrounding those historical events, they don't fit the definition of laissez-faire in my book because they include bad decisions by regulators, either by easing the lending requirements, giving away easy money, falling asleep at the regulatory wheel, not keeping an eye on the revolving door of Treasury, Federal Reserve, and bankers. A whole nine yards of things that we could look at to where I would argue it's not even laissez-faire, it's more like crony capitalism, where the people in power at the reins of some of these systems make sweetheart deals to enrich themselves. And you say, well, that's the backbone of laissez-faire. That's the pure definition of laissez-faire, is letting people do what they want to do. Not at the governmental regulatory level. That's called gaming the system. Big difference between that and laissez-faire. So when I think of laissez-faire, I think of Ludwig von Mises, who said that Laissez-faire is not letting soulless mechanical forces operate. Rather, it's letting individuals choose how they want to cooperate. So I'm going to talk about some laissez-faire fails that are in the vein of individuals outside of the realm of government and regulation decision-making powers make decisions to cooperate together, and the outcome was not what was intended. And there's a couple recent ones, and if we continued to examine the history books of Silicon Valley and entrepreneurial landscape, we could uncover hundreds, if not thousands, of similar instances. The first one that might be the most culturally in the short-term memory banks of our cultural psyche, perhaps, is the Fire Island debacle. And you say, well, what's Fire Island? F-Y-R-E. There's a great documentary on Netflix that looks at how this music festival went viral on social media through famous supermodels around the world posting information about this festival, detailing how a bunch of super loaded, super wealthy millennial kids scooped up these highly expensive tickets promising a beachside villa or via, depending on how you pronounce your double L's, catering, yachts, the whole nine yards. And then ultimately how it ended up being pretty much a false advertising campaign. They advertised something that they were not able to execute. The festival did not happen. Several lawsuits were put forth. The investors lost the money that they put into it. In fact, I read a couple articles that it's interesting, the production company behind the documentary on Netflix, and I guess there's another documentary on Amazon, I read an article that said that the production company behind both of those are actually backed by some of the investors who put money into the music festival to begin with in hopes of recouping some of their original money. So they're marketing the disaster of the festival in a documentarian sort of venue or way in order to hopefully recoup some money from their initial losses on the front end. And you say, well, that sounds terrible. A bunch of spoiled, rotten, rich, entitled, elitist millennial kids lost some money. Horrible, the injustice. I saw one guy on a news show say, hey, that's Darwinism at its finest. Spending $10,000 for a picture of a via or a villa that you don't even know exists. Guys generating millions of dollars in overnight online sales just because they paid some supermodels to post these pictures. They paid one of the Kardashians, I think, $500,000. They wired her 500 large. Maybe it was 250. It was either a quarter or a half a mil. They wired her an obscene amount of money to post one picture and hashtag it Fire Festival or Fire Island, whatever it was. And you're clearly seeing that's laissez-faire. People are choosing how to cooperate. The investor in Manhattan is choosing to put money into this festival. The guy who's leading it is choosing to take that money. He's choosing to go hire a videographer firm and a social media firm. He's choosing to spend that money to market this future festival. He's choosing to spend that money to develop an app, a fire app, which was supposedly going to allow people to privately book famous bands and musicians at their private functions and parties. You had the millennials choosing to buy tickets based upon the glamour that they saw from the supermodels posting these videos and pictures. You had people choosing to work on the island, promising to get paid, which apparently, according to the documentary I saw, they never did. So you have all of these individuals choosing to either spend money, invest money, distribute that money, promise the money, sell this image, and there's tons of people involved. I mean, there's literally, it's not an overstatement to say that there were over 1,000 people involved in this whole thing, and they're all choosing to interact in certain ways and yet the festival, they were not able to execute the venue. They failed on creating the villas. They failed on booking enough houses for the luxury single houses. They failed on getting the proper sound equipment, so the band started to back out. So the whole thing failed, and the investors lost their money. The millennials were conned. Ultimately, they feel like they were defrauded of their funds through false advertising and false promises, so they sued. The guy who founded the Fyre Festival is facing prison time. And so you get to this question of, well, clearly, Brandon, laissez-faire failed, and that's terrible, and we need to prevent that from happening. Another example. Elizabeth Holmes. If you haven't heard of Elizabeth Holmes, she is very similar to this Fyre guy, very charismatic, very passionate, very able to separate investors from their cash to back their vision. And she had a company called Theranos, Theranos. And if you haven't been following startup culture the last couple years, you clearly have heard of this woman. She defrauded, allegedly. I won't even use defrauded, even though she did. She raised $900 million to back this Theranos concept, where it was going to be a one prick blood test, and it would tell you like every possible thing you needed to know ever about your blood. And typically, these sorts of blood tests, you know, we've all done it. You've gone to the lab. They put a rubber band around your arm. They, you know, draw blood into a couple vials. They send it out for tests, and the results come back like a week or two later. So her pitch was, we're going to eliminate that 2 weeks, 1 or 2 week process. We're going to eliminate the need to go to the doctor's office, get the rubber band around your arm poked, all this discomfort. They pull out a couple vials. We're going to give you one poke, and bam, this machine's going to tell you everything just in seconds. Well, when you begin to read about the technology behind the actual pitch, a lot of people on the inside of the company started saying, hey, this is technically impossible right now. Like, this is scientifically undoable. We cannot deliver on this promise. And so it appears that she fired those types of people. If you were I don't even know if it's a whistleblower. If you were just a naysayer, they gave you the boot, which was similar with the Fyre Island. People who said, hey, we can't pull this off. His response was, either you get on board or you get out of here. We're looking for problem solvers, not pessimists. So very similar culture, very similar philosophy. She just kept raising money, selling the vision. And eventually the whole thing blew up, and it was revealed that the naysayers' claims were correct, that technology did not, what we know about blood and tests and the way this thing was supposed to work right now, it's impossible to pull this off. And so they all lost their money. I mean, and there were big time people in this. There was a general, a US, like a military general involved in backing it, tons of Silicon Valley people. And she is again facing fraud charges, prison time, the whole nine yards. And you go, Brennan, again, that's a terrible example. Laissez-faire failed. And so it brings me to this particular point. And I think this is where the kernel, the core of regulation, laissez-faire, command and control economies, all of these things, they kind of center around this main concept of one, a couple elements, but the first one is risk. And you go, oh, wow, that's so insightful. I never would have thought risk would be involved. Well, yeah, a lot of people, I think, don't realize that risk is inherent in everything we do. Risk is inherent in stepping out your front door. Risk is inherent in living another 10 seconds because maybe that's when your heart finally gives out. Maybe that's when your brain hemorrhages and you fall over from a stroke. Oh my gosh, you're so morbid. Risk is getting on a plane. There was a guy here 3 or 4 weeks ago here in Florida. He was just speeding down one of the main interstates in the middle of the day, doing like 70, 75 miles an hour, and a lightning bolt freaking hit him in the helmet, and it killed him. And I was going, wow. I mean, the odds of that happening, this guy's screaming down the freeway, and he essentially drives into a lightning bolt that hits him right on his helmet, right in the lane that he's in at the exact time. I mean, the calculation that goes into that to match the velocity with the lane he's in, with where that lightning bolt, I mean, if you don't think, when the Bible says it's appointed for every man to die once and then the judgment, there are several examples, morbid examples, of how that might be true, just maybe. So there's risk in everything. There's a guy that was fishing down here in Florida, and he got a 12-foot alligator jumped out of the canal and ate him. Like, I was going to say ate his lunch, which is kind of a weird smack talk way of getting mowed down by an alligator. But they found him. They found his dismembered body a couple days later, and they killed the alligator, and they did it. Is it a necropsy? What are they? It's not an autopsy because it's not a human. I think they call it a necropsy. I think that's what I remember reading. Some sort of animal autopsy. And they found his leg and arm in the alligator's belly. I mean, there's risk inherent in everything. 2 years ago, I remember reading about some teenage girl. It was actually in New Mexico, and that's why it stood out to me. They were on vacation driving through New Mexico, and they stayed at this hotel on their way through, and this teenage girl, 16 years old, decided to charge her iPhone but then take a bath, and the iPhone fell into the tub while it was plugged in charging, and she was electrocuted. I mean, there's risks involved in everything. People choke to death. I mean, just I don't need to belabor the point. I mean, just turn on the news. There's risks involved in everything. That's why the Final Destination movie franchise exists, because everybody is like, just realizes, hey, you know, I might get killed in a car wash because my sunroof won't close and I'm going to get flooded. I mean, some of the Final Destination stuff is just to the point of absurdity. But when you hear about a guy going 75 miles an hour down the freeway, boom, dead, you go, okay, hey, there are some things outside of my control here. So risk is inherent. And I think the laissez-faire and the more regulated command and control, they are different approaches to managing that risk. And the other big player involved in this is, alongside the risk, is inequality and loss. And as humans, I think we're wired to want justice, want equity, want fairness. You know, maybe some of us don't, but that's only until our consciences are seared beyond recognition and you know, we have no moral fiber left in our being, which happens to a lot of people who commit to liberal ideologies. I don't know why I get so much fun making fun of liberals. I know it happens to people who delve into their conservative ideology as well. But losses, inequality, those are real problems. And so laissez-faire and command and control regulated approaches, they're trying to deal with the real existence of risk and of inequality and losses. And it's my observation, and this is where we're going to get to why I believe in laissez-faire, when you take a command and control, you take an extreme regulation approach to risk and to inequality, you're trying to prevent risk. You're trying to eliminate risk. You're trying to prevent inequality. You're trying to eliminate inequality. And when you do that, it's an impossible quest. And I think it's in the vein of when the free market Austrian economists talk about the fatal conceit. You know, they have this concept of it's the fatal conceit. It's the pride. It's the conceit to think that we, this group of people, this power structure, this planned whatever, is smart enough to prevent another fire festival from happening. It's smart enough and powerful enough to prevent another Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes from happening. And the fatal conceit, in my estimation and my reading of history, has resulted in full system failure over and over and over and over and over again. Venezuela, communist Russia, all of the small Eastern European communist structures that imploded with too much excessive regulation, rationing of food, people standing in line for milk, running out of milk, people standing in line for eggs, getting oil for heat rationed, you know, not having enough electricity. I mean, all of the horror stories you hear about there not being enough resources and people suffering as a result of a lack of resources, they're always associated with command and control, fatal conceit type regulated systems. And so they're responding to the same risk and inequality and losses that are present, but it's the fatal conceit which says we can eliminate the risk and we can eliminate the inequality and we can eliminate the losses. And it's my position that if you believe that you can eliminate risk, inequality, and loss, you are already setting out on an impossible task. So you are ultimately going to fail. And I think that's why you've seen so many countries crash and burn on this front. Whether it's hyperinflation in Zimbabwe or hyperinflation in Argentina in the late 90s or the hyperinflation that struck Brazil and all these other places. It's a desire to try to eliminate the risk, eliminate the inequality, and eliminate the loss. And it's just a fantasy. It's impossible. And you go, oh, but that sounds so terrible. I don't want to have risk. I don't want to have losses. I don't want to have inequality. Yeah. I mean, they're not comfortable, but they're real and they exist. And we have not been able to eliminate them. And so even in the face of failure after failure after failure after failure of a combination of socialist, communist, command and control, dictatorial, authoritarian, centrally planned debacles, people continue to insist, oh, it's just because we haven't done it correctly. We just need to tinker a little bit more. And again, it's just driving home the fatal conceit. And it's because millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of individuals trying to make decisions, that's ultimately going to be smarter than a handful of people forcing everybody to make the same decision. And you go, oh, but, so what's the difference with laissez-faire? Laissez-faire recognizes there's risk, inequality, and loss. And instead of trying to eliminate it, they spread it out among millions and millions and millions and millions of people. And so the risk is contained. The losses are contained. The inequality is much more contained. And when I say contained, I mean it's dispersed among. So you take one, if you took a big chunk, like let's say that risk and inequality and loss was like one big blob of mass. It was just a massive blob. A command and control regulated structure would take that one big blob and dump it as one big thing, and everybody has to feel that. The laissez-faire system takes that blob and it breaks it up into a ton of smaller chunks. And it throws some of that blob onto the fire festival. And it throws a chunk of that blob onto the Theranos folks. And so it breaks up and distributes that gunky blob of risk and loss and inequality. And it allows people who want to assume that and carry that potential blob of gunk, it lets them carry it, and then people who don't want to carry it, okay, they don't have to. I mean, so a lot of people lost a lot of money on Fire Island. I didn't. I'm willing to bet money that you didn't. I mean, probably 330 million people in America. I'm guessing that 329 million and a very high 100,000 percentage 100,000 count of people were not affected at all by Fire Island. I'm guessing there's 330 million people in America. I'm guessing that 329 million and again a very high 100,000 800,000 and some people or more in America felt no effects from the risk, inequality, and loss of Theranos. It's contained to the people who want to assume it. And I think that this is the biggest difference between laissez-faire and command and control. Regulated command and control, thinks they're smart enough to eliminate risk, loss, and inequality. They're not, so everybody's forced to suffer. It's almost like spoiled kids were like, oh, if I can't play, then nobody can play. So then they break their toy. You know, that's what command and control regulated economy kind of, you know, advocates remind me of. Sort of spoiled, impetuous, you know, just kind of bratty people who are like, well, if nobody can have it, then, you know, if I can't have it, then nobody can have it. And then they ruin it for everybody. Whereas laissez-faire says, hey, you know what, whatever, you know, go do your thing. And, you know, if we get left holding the bag, we get left holding the bag. And I think that's why the financial crisis of 08 is so nefarious. And I think that's why the Great Depression is so nefarious, is because it was done under the guise of laissez-faire, but it really wasn't. It's an insider command and control gaming of the system, which when it broke, they insisted that everybody hold the bag. Oh, too big to fail. You got to bail us out. And this is where we get to the regulation side of laissez-faire. And you go, well, you're just say advocating for anarchy. No, the regulatory side of laissez-faire is bankruptcy. It's jail time for committing fraud. I mean, the Fire Island guy, when he was raising money, he put on his personal investment, you know, prospectus that he had over $250,000 in Facebook shares. So people thought, oh, this is a, you know, I'm backing a guy who's actually savvy investor and he's got some cash and, you know, he's got some wherewithal. Well, it turns out he only had $1,400 in change worth of Facebook stock. He inflated other things on his financial statements. I haven't read the Theranos girl in depth, but it wouldn't surprise me one bit if she was, you know, giving faulty numbers as well. So you ask, well, what's the regulatory side of laissez-faire? It's bankruptcy. It's fraud. It's losing $900 million. It's, you know, the investors in Fire Island lost, I think one chick put $3 million in. I think they raised a total of 30 to get the whole thing done. I mean, it's losing. It's losses. That's the regulatory side. And you go, oh, but that's terrible. Well, no, that they know that going in on the front end. There is risk. This is a high-risk endeavor. And I think it actually gets to answering the inequality as well, because, you know, everybody loves to pick on, this venture capitalist, he made $1.5 billion on this deal. The audacity, what a greedy SOB. If we looked at his portfolio in its entirety, I'm sure that he has $900 million losses on Theranos wrapped up into that thing as well. You know, it's like the professional poker players. You turn on the World Series of Poker on ESPN, and they say, oh, he has career winnings. Doesn't say career profit. Says he has career winnings of $1.65 million. He's amazing. Well, how many $10,000 and $15,000 and $25,000 buy-ins did he participate in order to rack up those winnings? And how many times did he, you know, so you really need to look at what is the spread between the winnings and the costs associated with all the money he's lost. And that's how we view these investors. We view these investors as, oh, they're so greedy. They took $1 billion and they exited that deal. Well, they might have had 5 or 6 or 10 or 15 or 2 where they lost as much, if not more money than that. And nobody's crying from the rooftops for them when they lose $900 million. I mean, nobody's pounding the pavement going, oh, those poor venture capitalists, they lost $900 million on Theranos. We need to do a GoFundMe campaign to help them. No, you go, screw those guys. F those guys. Hey, you know, so what? Hey, that's what you get for putting your money behind some 27-year-old whack job or however old she was. I mean, we don't have sympathy for investors when they lose money, but we grate with envy and jealousy when they make money. It's ridiculous. I mean, the hypocrisy and the double standard of, you know, we don't feel for people when they lose their shirts in ventures. We deride them and mock them and berate them. Oh, what a fool. But then when one of their investments strikes and they hit money, then it's, oh, those greedy bastards. It's just the human heart. We're so evil. I mean, we envy people who succeed. We pile on top of people who fail. And I'm looking at myself in the mirror right now going, oh, geez, I might do this a little bit too much. And I feel like, once again, making fun of Nicholas Mahut for running into tennis balls 3 times. Ha ha, loser. And to add insult to injury, he actually lost the match. Not only did he get pelted numerous times, they lost a tough 5-setter. And what even makes it funnier to me is Nicholas Mahut is the guy that lost the 3-day match to John Isner back in, what, 2011? 2012? I think it was 2011. 2010? I think it was maybe, it was either 2010 or 2011. When they had that 70-68 fifth set with John Isner. He lost that match as well. So not only did he lose a 3-day match playing the equivalent of like 19 matches to John Isner, he also got pelted 3 times and lost the men's final. So I'm going to join in with all of you profit-hating, investor-loathing people and dogpile on Mahut for losing as well. Ha ha. So really the difference in my mind between regulated command and control structures and laissez-faire systems, again, is that the regulated command and control dumps the blob on everybody and insists that everybody carry the pain, whereas a laissez-faire system lets the people who took the risk carry the pain, and it lets the people carry the reward who their risk turned out well for them. And is it perfect? No, not at all. I mean, laissez-faire is not perfect. But I would rather have I would rather have 10,000 fire islands and have 329 million of us not feel any of those effects than I would have a heavy-handed command and control structure where 100 regulators or 10 regulators make bad decisions and then we're all standing in line for milk. Romania, back in the day. You know, we're climbing over zoo fences to kill flamingos to try to eat so we don't die. Venezuela, current day. I'd rather have that. I'd rather have 10,000 Theranoses and Fire Islands and Enrons and whatever. And Enron, I don't even know if Enron would apply to my laissez-faire system because it's getting back up into that realm of regulatory malfeasance. That's a great word, malfeasance. I love that word. I want to say it's a self-evident word, but that would be totally stupid, and it would just be me desperately attempting to annoy a particular family member with more self-evident tomfoolery. Oh, midweek musings. Midweek musings. Oh, you're mocking lispers. I had a lisp when I was in 7th grade. I actually had to go to speech therapy. 7th grade, when I was 7 years old. 7 years old. I think I did, we were there for 2-3 months. So I think I did maybe 2 or 3 months of 2nd grade before we bailed and went somewhere else. But I got sent to a speech therapy class, and when my parents found out, they flipped their lids. I think that contributed to me getting homeschooled again. I was homeschooled a lot early on, and then it just stuck when I got out of 5th grade. My parents yanked me out of 5th grade because I was at another elementary school. Let me see how many elementary schools. Kindergarten was Flagstaff. Part of 1st grade was Sedona. Part of 2nd grade was Prescott. 3rd grade was homeschool all over the place. 4th grade was homeschool. And then Edgewood, New Mexico. And then part of 5th grade. I actually got pulled out of 5th grade and bumped up to 5th grade because they said I was like too smart or something. And then I got to 5th grade at a different elementary school in a different city. And I think I came home and told my parents that I didn't want to be smart anymore because it wasn't cool, so I wanted to be dumb. And they were like, all right, you're going back to homeschool. And we're moving to our compound. So yeah, there we go. I don't know if that... I think that's a better treatment to laissez-faire than whatever the previous treatment was, where I just sort of buried my head in the sand. Yeah, so laissez-faire fails. It fails a lot. But the failures are contained. They're not, it's not required reading, so to speak. It's not a requirement of laissez-faire for everyone to carry the bag when the Fire Island thing goes to pot and the Elizabeth Holmes chick defrauds her investors out of 900 mil. You say, oh, but there's examples where companies went bankrupt and 10,000 people got laid off. Yeah. Yeah, there probably are. And I should probably continue to look for these laissez-faire failures. But that probably gets at the other thing, which I wasn't going to hit on, but I think it's forcing me to, is that volatility and dynamism and volatility are part of economic realities. And I think that's another part of the fatal conceit, the pipe dream, the utopian fiasco that command and control people pursue, is that, oh, we can get things set and they can remain that way forever. That's not how progress works. Progress is very disruptive. I mean, it's incredibly disruptive. You go, oh no, that's not, I mean, look at it biologically. I mean, your body sheds its skin multiple times throughout some time period, which I'm not exactly sure what it is. I want to say your body sheds its skin like every couple days. How frequently, I could have used often and saved myself a lot of keystrokes. How frequently does human trafficking occur? Wow, Google. How frequently does human body shed skin? Humans shed about 600,000 particles of skin every hour. That is disgusting, and it makes me never want to ever breathe again in my life. Where is the biohazard apocalypse mask immediately? I haven't bought anything on Amazon in almost 2 years, but that might cause me to crack to get a biohazard mask immediately. We shed about 1.5 pounds of skin a year. By 70 years of age, an average person will have lost 105 pounds of skin. Ugh. I want to throw up. Humans shed and regrow outer skin cells about every 27 days. Almost 1,000 entirely new skins in a lifetime. If you can see the look on my face right now. Ugh. That would make an interesting infographic. Maybe that's my next infographic. Although it's probably going to make me throw up. 100, so I'm 40. That means 105 is 52 and a half. I'm over 35. So I've probably lost 60 pounds of skin in my day. Ugh. And that's just floating around. You know what makes me actually feel kind of the consoling fact in all of this disgustingness is that there's a good chance that you're breathing in some of my old skin. Somebody somewhere is breathing in B-Muth. Oh, but that's disgusting because it means I'm breathing in like thousands of other people. Ugh. Hopefully the skin... Actually, you know what? Actually, my science is probably faulty. My scientific consensus is off base. And probably the skin cells, they're probably too heavy to stay airborne for too long, so they just fall into the carpet. So when little Johnny faceplants, like I talked about a while ago, when he faceplants, he's breathing in your relatives. Oh, gross. That's gross. How did I get on skin shedding? Risk, systemic failure. Yeah. How come I always have these? Every single episode, I have a crossroads where I can't remember from whence I came. Where goest thou? I don't remember. I have Ely Anastasi still opened on that tab, but that was a long time ago. So spreads it out, shedding skin, I don't know. It just spreads it out. Oh, disruption, that's what it was. Biology is naturally very, very disruptive. Growth is very disruptive. When trees grow, they shed bark, they crack, they all this kind of stuff. I mean, growth is disruptive. So this pie in the sky fantasy that's non-existent that says, oh, we can just get things operating perfectly and then they'll never change, it doesn't work. And the best example of this that I know of is communist Russia, at the height of the communist USSR, they had a central pricing authority, and they had a department with less than a dozen people, if I remember my economic reading correctly. They were in charge of setting and updating the prices on over 27 million products in Russia. And no vendor, no store, no anybody could change the price at all unless the price change came from the central command. And you go, oh, that's not too hard of a job. I mean, just update the spreadsheet and, you know, just push it out digitally. Well, this is, one, this is before any of that stuff existed. So, you know, difficult. And two, for all of you math whizzes out there, there's only 33 million seconds in a year. So you're telling me that a dozen people, ooh, let's up it to two dozen. Let's get the job. Let's promise them jobs and give them a steady wage. A dozen people are supposed to set prices on 27 million products when there's only 33 million seconds in an entire year. Like, do you not see the self-evidentiary? I don't even know if evidentiary is the right word. Do you not see how obvious it is that that's a pursuit of absolute folly? There's not enough time to set the price for every single product, let alone be responsive to shortages and surpluses and all kinds of stuff. It's a fool's game. And it's so obnoxious to me that people continue to want to insist. And I get it. Oh, we want to eliminate risk. We want to eliminate inequality. We want to eliminate losses. I get the sentiment, but it's impossible. So if you're risk averse, instead of advocating for a system that screws everybody, simply make individual decisions that are low risk. It's pretty easy. I mean, don't give money. Don't become a venture capitalist. You know, put your money in places where historically it has proven to be very unvolatile. U.S. bonds, which don't even get me started on bonds in the Treasury Department and all that stuff. We'll just pretend. We'll just put on our World War II rose-colored glasses and just pretend that all of that stuff is above the board and not a game of small percentage profit played out on maximum crazy amounts of dollar bills. But yeah, put it places where it's traditionally not very volatile. You know, live way below your means. Don't buy a flashy car. Don't invest in some condo project in Miami. I mean, it's pretty easy. If you're risk averse, it's pretty easy to live in a laissez-faire system and not expose yourself to risk. You know, don't invest in the stock market. Put it in a 0.25% interest-bearing savings account. You know, put it in a box and bury it under your bed. I mean, there's a lot of ways to be risk averse. Without insisting that everybody else get screwed in the process. So I really do believe we need to advocate even more vehemently, that's a word I've been going to lately, for more laissez-faire in our economy. Because laissez-faire spreads things out between millions and millions and millions and millions of individuals. And the more command and control we get, i.e. the 2008 financial crisis of, oh, we're too big to fail. Which, by the way, if you really want some reading material, Google Bloomberg FOIA request on Federal Reserve expenditures around that time. And what they uncovered, you know, remember the TARP funds? It was like, oh, we need this money. $700 billion in TARP. And the first time around, the House kiboshed it. The House said, screw you guys. You don't need $700 billion. Hank Paulson and Ben Bernanke and you clowns. You don't need this money, you deceitful gaming the system profiteers. And then probably the big banks called and said, hey, if you want money for your reelection campaign, you're going to change your vote there, pal. But my point is, Bloomberg News Organization did a Freedom of Information request on the Federal Reserve. And lo and behold, right after TARP was failed, it didn't pass the first time around in the House, Like 3 hours later, I think it was 3 hours later that afternoon, the Federal Reserve secretly dispersed like $600 and some billion to the banks, which was coincidentally, in quotes, close to the dollar amount of TARP. And then they did another Freedom of Information request, and they found that over the next 18 months that the Federal Reserve had $16 trillion. Maybe it was $13 trillion. I think it was $16 trillion worth of off-balance book transactions at the discount window between themselves and several of the banks. Yeah. So when I said we need to regulate the regulators, yep, we need to start there. Don't regulate the Fire Island guy. Regulate the regulators. And at the end of the day, prosecute the Fire Island guy. You know, because here's the thing. If he would have pulled it off, we wouldn't even be talking about the failure of laissez-faire. And just as I said, there's probably thousands of examples we could find of failed startup when laissez-faire fails. We could find thousands of examples when laissez-faire succeeds as well. Yeah, if the guy would have pulled it off, we wouldn't even be talking about him. In fact, he'd be on the when laissez-faire succeeds. But he didn't pull it off, so we're talking about it in relation to how it failed. So prosecute him. False advertising, prosecute him. Fraud, prosecute him. Falsifying investment documents, prosecute him. You want to sue him to get your $10,000 villa fee back for selling you fake stuff? Prosecute him, which they have. He's serving jail time and paying money. And I'm sure Elizabeth Holmes is going to be in prison on several of the similar charges. Fraud, money laundering, misuse of funds, blah, 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 blah. Misleading investors. So prosecute him. But here's the thing. When I say we need to regulate the regulators, and it goes back to a quote I shared about Matt Taibbi or whatever his name is from Rolling Stone saying, throw Lloyd Blankfein and pound me in the AWS prison and this would stop. It's that we don't prosecute the regulators. When the regulators have malfeasance and they do the same things that this Fire Island guy did and the Elizabeth Holmes chick did, we don't prosecute them. And then we go, oh, look, laissez-faire is failing. No, crony capitalism is failing. It's not laissez-faire. Crony capitalism is failing. So whatever. That's where I'm going with that. Where are we at? How many minutes are we into this? Hey, look, plug-in sales. 52 minutes when laissez-faire fails. Midweek musings. All right, I'm going to stop there. We'll get into the ridiculous Scientific American Fat article and the oppressive nature of dodgeball at a later date. Have a wonderful day. Hope your week is going well. Midweek musings. Where are we at? What are we at? The count always gets me. I'm just going to start calling these half episodes. Midweek musings. So this would be Muthonomics 27 and a half. It's like Naked Gun 33 and a third. Muthonomics 26 and a half. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. Peace. Have a good rest of the week, and we'll see you on Saturday.